Kia ora koutou. Welcome to the New Zealand General Practice Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Joe Scott Jones. Earlier seasons of this podcast focused on joint practice. This season is an opportunity to listen in on monthly conversations I have with Dr. Dave Mapleston, organised for the Pinnacle GP Network. Dave shares insights into important clinical changes he picks up in his reading as a part-time GP and advisor to the Health and Disability Commissioner. I hope you enjoy. You're Dave, how are you?
Very well, thank you very much. Just leave the cat in the window, sorry.
It's good to know that you're human as well, Dave, as well as an immense brain.
Thank you.
So, welcome to this month's clinical snippets. What have you got for us today, Dave?
Again, just a bit of a trip around the human body, starting with the legs and ending with the genitals.
So hopefully
that will be interesting.
Lovely. It sounds fascinating. Let's kick it off.
Yeah, the first thing I'm talking about is superficial venous thrombosis. So I'll refer to SVT, but it's the veins, not the heart.
Yeah.
And this arises from a case I've looked at recently where there's a complaint that a patient had presented to the GP with a significant SVT on their leg, which was treated with topical medication. And about 5 or 6 days later, they collapsed and died, and post-mortem showed they died from a DVT.
Yeah.
And it just led me to revisit the Health Pathways guidance on SVT. I mean, in the past, I've certainly usually prescribed, gotten to pick up a tube of Hirudoid from the chemist and maybe a compression stocking,
yeah,
and thought that was reasonable. But the recommendations probably have altered a bit over time, mainly because of increasing evidence of the association between SVT and DVT.
Yes.
So while the SVT is usually a benign self-limiting condition, when it involves the smaller tributary veins in the lower limb or an existing varicose vein, when the main axial veins, which are the saphenous veins, great and small saphenous veins, are involved, or there's SVT close to the saphenofemoral junction, there's a risk of DVT. And that may DVT may actually coexist at the time of the diagnosis of the SVT, or it may extend to the deep veins within several days.
Yeah.
So the risk for venous thromboembolism is the highest immediately following the diagnosis of SVT, but persists over time, particularly in the first 3 months, and decreasing, but it's still significantly higher after 5 years.
Wow.
Which I found quite interesting, because part history of recent SVT is not a risk factor on the Wells score when you're querying a DVT, but yeah, there is an associated risk.
Yes.
So we know that the diagnosis, it's a clinical diagnosis, tenderness, induration, pain, or erythema along the course of a superficial vein. And the D-dimer is not considered sensitive or specific enough to predict DVT when you've got a patient with an SVT.
Yeah.
So basically the recommendations are that when to arrange an ultrasound to exclude DVT is if there's any involved segment of vein of 5 centimeters or more, or either the great or small saphenous vein is involved, or if there's asymmetrical leg swelling, even if it's apparently an SVT rather than suspicion for DVT. Mm. And then to consider full oral anticoagulation for 3 months if the SVT is within 3 centimeters of the saphenofemoral junction, or if the area involved is confirmed to be more than 5 centimeters, and probably to seek vascular surgery advice if the SVT is very close to the saphenofemoral junction. And there's also a recommendation to consider full oral anticoagulation if there are other risk factors for DVT, even if there's no DVT confirmed on the ultrasound. Mm-hmm. And they stay safe, for example, an inpatient, but I presume you might seek hematology advice if your patient's got a coexistent cancer, or, you know, got their leg in a cast or something like that. And then if there aren't any risk factors, standard analgesia, NSAIDs for 8 to 12 days, if not contraindicated, elevation and compression stockings, and encourage the patient to remain ambulatory. But probably quite importantly, arrange follow-up at 7 to 10 days or earlier if there is deterioration of the SVT. So again, if it seems to be extending, even if it wasn't 5 centimeters at the start, you'd get concerned if it was extending rather than resolving over that period. Yeah. So I think, again, it's really attaching a bit more significance to the larger SVTs, and particularly those in the axial veins, and being aware of that significantly increased risk of associated DVT.
Yeah. So that makes me want to revise my anatomy, although I was doing this recently I did a point of care ultrasound course, and where actually this came up as well. So, the value of having point of care ultrasound to in the practice to be able to say, well, is this close to the saphenofemoral junction? Is it more than 5 centimeters? It just adds that extra modality that you can use to add into your clinical decision making. But I think it came as news to me. You've always known that there's an association between superficial venous thrombosis and DVT, that it was, I had picked up that was a risk factor, but this really codifies it. It gives a very clear indication. You need to follow people up if they've got an SVT. You need to see them again a week or 10 days later to see if it's progressed. They don't mention hirudoid cream in the treatment of
it? Not in the treatment, no. But it's always been my go-to in the past. I think I did look up to see what the evidence base is for it, and it is actually pretty thin.
Yeah.
But it always felt good prescribing it, so because you're doing something.
Yeah, I think I gave non-steroidal anti-inflammatory cream to sort of gently rub into it if it worked to soothe the pain. But it was otherwise you're just reassuring people, really, the compression stockings and simple pain relief.
So that was I must confess too, I had to relook at my anatomy book to see where the small saphenous vein went, which is basically down the middle of the calf at the back.
Yeah.
And the greater saphenous more medially in the thighs.
Because that was the other thing, was that these are below knee, where previously would sort of been a bit of an indication that perhaps if the thrombosis is below the knee, then it doesn't really matter quite so much. So yeah, it's a big, I think that's quite a big change.
Yeah. So just I guess keeping aware of when we need to be worried and just a bit more vigilant over, as you say, progression, if someone's got one of these. A couple of medication ones. First one's around the risk of ACE inhibitors and angioedema, which CALMS put out a report recently of a fatal reaction to angioedema when a person was prescribed an ACE after, I don't think they admitted, but they had previously had an episode of angioedema with an ACE some years before, and they were re-prescribed.
So CALM is the Center for Adverse Reactions in Medicines, I think?
Center for Adverse Reactions Monitoring.
Monitoring
of adverse reactions to medications. Yeah. And again, I just, while I'm on that topic, they've got an electronic notification process, which is much easier than the old forms we used to have to fill in. And New Zealand actually has one of the best notification rates for adverse reactions internationally, but still only a tiny proportion of adverse reactions are notified.
Right.
So it's not that difficult to do. And I'll put a push out for if you're suspicious of any adverse reaction to a medication, it's helpful, I think, to notify CALM just so they're aware of any trends or issues. But the importance of this one is, or the information that the CALM have given out for prescribers is reinforcing that before you prescribe an ACE, ask a patient if they've ever taken this type of medication before and if they had any adverse reaction, and specifically ask about swelling. So because it may have been a reasonably minor presentation of angioedema, moderately swollen lips or tongue, but that's still highly relevant. And inform patients who are starting an ACE about the symptoms of angioedema and advise them to seek urgent medical attention if these occur. A small proportion of patients might actually get visceral angioedema, which actually presents as a diffuse abdominal pain and diarrhea.
Mm.
And in more than half of the cases where it was visceral angioedema, that was the adverse reaction, symptoms began within 72 hours of starting the ACE. Usually, although occasionally, as with the classic symptoms, the angioedema may develop weeks or even years after therapy. So it's just a matter of keeping it in the back of your mind.
Goodness. So weeks or years after
you've started. Yep. So with the ACE.
So whilst you're still taking it. Not,
yes.
Okay. Yep. Yeah.
So the and in fact, I've had a patient who developed angioedema would have been at least 2 years after starting the ACE.
Right.
Having had nothing at all suspicious in that first couple of years.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense, doesn't it? If you're going to get an immune reaction, it is to something that your body is familiar with and then starts to react to. So, but yep. The fact that it comes along later on is something that we need to be monitor. It's part of our when we're monitoring patients and thinking about. I suppose again with abdominal pain and diarrhea, you might your diagnostic tree might you take you down all sorts of routes.
Yeah, but I think that it would be. It would be easier to make that diagnosis if it was clearly a recent sort of temporal relationship to starting the ACE. But if it's you know, a year later, you'd be thinking about all sorts of other things that would be not high up on your list of differentials.
And probably quite rightly so too, because this is going to be quite a rare event. But you would need to exclude the cancer.
But file it in the back of your mind.
Yes.
So most patients can be cautiously switched to an ARB. And a proportion of patients will still have recurrence of the angioedema after stopping the culprit ACE, most commonly within the first month.
A proportion. Okay.
Yeah, I'm not sure what they meant. They said a proportion. I'm not sure what that proportion is, because it could be anything from one millionth to to a quarter, but some. So New Zealand formulary also advises against the use of Entresto in patients with a previous angioedema with an ACE.
Okay.
So it's a contraindication to Entresto. Also, not that we're usually starting that, but we may be starting it on the advice of a cardiologist, I suppose. And then just on the drug update topic, there's the special authority criteria for ivermectin have been recently amended. It was just last month. So we can now, any relevant practitioner can now complete the special authority form for ivermectin in patients with scabies and close contacts who meet special authority criteria. So discussion with a dermatologist, infectious diseases specialist, or clinical microbiologist is no longer required to access ivermectin in those cases.
Right. And we're not going to mention COVID in this?
No, I think it should be pretty much done and dusted. All of the recent systematic reviews and things I've looked at on in relation to use of ivermectin, there is not a single one that shows any shred of evidence for efficacy.
But let's just make sure that we haven't mentioned COVID in this discussion. Ivermectin for scabies, there's a new special authority, but we didn't say anything about COVID at all other than that. Okay, that's cool.
In a negative sense,
yeah, cool.
And there's a good article, I've put a link in the snippets to a really good BPAC update article on treatment of scabies, management of scabies. Again, it's a topic that comes up regularly in complaints from aged care facilities, usually around delayed diagnosis of scabies in an old person who's got dry, itchy skin,
right?
Which of course is extremely common in old people, but just to always keep scabies in the differential.
That's right. So Grover's disease in those older men, the sort of dry, itchy skin around the trunk and so on, is it's a very easy diagnosis to make because there isn't, it's a clinical diagnosis and there's no, it's just a question of moisturizing.
Yep.
Yeah. You might not think about scabies in those people. So definitely.
And the heavier the infestation, often the more atypical the picture looks.
Right. Okay.
So you get rather than getting the classic burrows, you just get sort of thickened scale around the fingers and on the back. So again, I've seen kind of diagnostic anchoring in these situations where the patient gets diagnosed maybe with a funny form of psoriasis and starts using steroid creams, which seem to be kind of partially effective because they suppress the inflammation. But scabies.
Okay.
So the next one, again, on the medication theme, and this is from a recent New Zealand Doctor article, and talking about the allopurinol, so treatment of gout, but particularly around variable adherence. And probably some of the important points they bring up. First one is that in a person who's become non-adherent to allopurinol, even for 1 month, don't automatically restart at a previous dose. You need to retitrate right from the low dose, working up again.
Mm.
And titration is dependent on the renal function. There's a link to a BPAC article which gives you the details around that. If your starting dose will be dependent on renal function and then working up to the dose required to reach the target.
Yeah.
And it just brings up the whole issue again of repeat prescribing. You know, how many of us look to really, you know, see when they picked up their last script for allopurinol. Was it 3 months ago exactly, or was it 6 months ago, or was it 5 months ago? And we automatically re-prescribe at the previous dose. So there is certainly risk attached to not being vigilant around the adherence and observation of adherence. And the main issue is one of the main issues is the risk of allopurinol hypersensitivity syndrome, which is dose dependent and rapidity of titration dependent, and is a nasty drug reaction.
Possibly fatal, I understand.
About mortality rate of 27%.
Wow.
Of the more severe, the hypersensitivity syndrome involves DRESS,
right.
Stephen Johnson syndrome, and TEN, toxic epidermal necrolysis. So I think with the more severe forms of it, mortality rate of up to 27%. So it's not negligible.
No.
And the risk factors for developing the hypersensitivity syndrome are the higher starting dose of allopurinol and rapid titration, recent commencement, usually within 6 to 8 weeks of allopurinol, co-administration of diuretics, especially thiazides. And there is a link with a concurrent prescription of amoxicillin, which causes a rash. And I looked into this and I couldn't figure out whether they were saying that it makes an amoxicillin related rash more likely, or whether the amoxicillin makes a allopurinol rash more likely, but it's there's certainly an association between the two.
Yeah.
So the other issues they brought up or advice was remembering anti-inflammatory prophylaxis when commencing allopurinol, and remember to stop this when stable. So that might be low dose NSAID or colchicine or prednisone if the alternatives aren't tolerated. And usually 3 to 6 months of anti-inflammatory prophylaxis is required, although it might be much longer in people with a high urate burden. And that's to prevent the flares that cause people to stop taking the allopurinol. So it's linked up with the adherence side of things. But also to remember, you know, once they've had their 3 to 6 months, to reverse titrate the anti-inflammatory prophylaxis. So that's not an indefinite thing. So the other interesting thing I found out about the allopurinol hypersensitivity syndrome is there's a gene-related increased risk. So the risk is nearly 100-fold higher in carriers of the HLA-B5801-LL than in non-carriers. This sounds like something we don't even need to be concerned about, except that New Zealand formulary recommends genetic testing in high-risk patients and avoiding allopurinol in confirmed carriers unless there is no suitable alternative. So the populations with high LL frequency include people of Han Chinese, so 6 to 8% of these will have the gene, Korean 12%, and Thai 6 to 8%. And again, I don't think we see these ethnicities having a particularly high incidence of gout, but just yet another thing to file away somewhere.
When we were involved in introducing pharmacogenomics, this was one of the key use cases internationally to identify this risk. Because again, you know, if you can reduce the chances of getting the hypersensitivity syndrome, 27% mortality, if we had easy access to genetic testing, this would be a one of the really good use cases for it, I think. Although you may have different opinion, Dave. I don't know.
Well, I think, you know, when you're looking at 100-fold increase in risk, I think, you know, if it was a 10-fold increase in risk, you'd start to think about the cost benefit side of things. But when there's such a significantly increase in the risk, so your risk in outside of these high risk groups is about 1 to 4 per 1,000 patients. So 100 times increase in risk, that's 400 per 1,000 patients, which is, you know, 1 in 2 just about, isn't it? So yeah, I think, you know, I would say it's justified in this population, or these populations. I'm not sure how easy it is to access.
Currently in New Zealand, it's really difficult to access the genomic tests, and it's So, but it's, I think that's something for the future, certainly.
Yeah. And then I've put a link into the SaferRx website on more details around safe prescribing of allopurinol, which again is quite a valuable resource to have. And the other issue with this is inequity. So Māori and Pacific people are obviously inequitably burdened by gout, but also there's also evidence that Māori and Pacific are less likely to receive regular allopurinol prescriptions. So therefore, they're at increased risk of this adverse, these adverse effects of irregular prescribing. And as usual, I'll do a push for Hei Ako Haringa website, where you can find your own, with your own prescribing and your practice prescribing by ethnicity, how many prescriptions are prescribed on a three-monthly basis or other than a three-monthly basis. So give you some insight into adherence amongst your practice population.
For those involved with the Pinnacle Network, a gout clinical dashboard in the pipeline as well. Hey, what about probenecid and what is it, febuxostat?
Febuxostat.
I mean, does that have the same issues? And I take daily medication, and you know, it's really hard to keep taking medication the same. I manage it most of the time. Certainly been in a position where I've had to avoid my medication for a couple of weeks while I've waited for my GP and the pharmacist to sort out repeating my prescription for me. And if I was on allopurinol, then that would be a start again, you know?
Yeah. And I think it probably all links back to how well informed the patient is when the medication is started.
Yeah.
So if you're informed of that risk, A, you'll be aware of it. B, you might be less likely to let the gap happen. But certainly up in Northland, there was a project where the clinical pharmacists, I think, took over. GP would say, you know, we want allopurinol initiated for this patient. Mm. They took over the initiation and titration process, the education, anti-inflammatory prophylaxis, the whole package, spent time with the patient. And I think it did show that there was significantly better adherence and control.
Bruce Arrell had some really good advice around that as well, in terms of setting up pharmacy packs for the initiation of gout. So in agreement with your pharmacist, saying this is the, can you set up a pack? But of course, then there's the extra cost of having everything laid out in a medico pack or whatever for the patient, which, so there's lots of things that we could do better. But do you know, can you stop and start for Febuxostat?
I don't see any reason why not, because it has a different mechanism of action to allopurinol. But
And the issue here is this hypersensitivity syndrome, which is more likely if you stop and start. So
which is more specific to allopurinol.
Okay.
Down to legs again. So again, this one came out of another recent case I did, where a patient was complaining about their elderly family member being in extreme pain with dressing changes for chronic venous ulcers. I'd been aware in the past that there have been studies showing topical application of local anesthetics might have interfered with wound healing, but in fact, Emla cream, so it's prilocaine lidocaine cream, has a listed indication as topical anesthesia of leg ulcers to facilitate mechanical cleansing or debridement, with instructions applied under an occlusive dressing for 30 to 60 minutes before the procedure.
Wow.
So for some bizarre reason, it says don't use any in the arms or other open wounds, but it has this indication for chronic leg ulcers. It's also been studied as a primary dressing for painful leg ulcers and has proved effective. So that is mixing it with or applying to the dressing that you're using on the wound for more long-lasting pain relief, other than just associated with the dressing changes. Main issue here is the cost. So the cheapest version I could find is the 30-gram tube under the brand name Numit, which is about $45 from Chemist Warehouse.
Seriously?
So, so it is the same. It's the same makeup as Emla, but about $15 a 30-gram tube cheaper, but still pretty expensive.
I'd love to have been in the marketing meeting that decided on that name. That's fantastic.
Numit.
Numit.
Sounds like something a frog would say, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But interestingly, the New Zealand Palliative Care Handbook also notes the use of topical morphine as local pain relief for palliative patients with fungating wounds or ulcers. And the instructions there are you use the morphine injection added to a gel like intracyte gel or KY jelly or metronidazole if they've got a smelly wound. So adding the liquid morphine to the gel and using that topically. the more detailed instructions in some NHS guidance I came across, which I've added, put a link to in the snippets, and just noting it's an off-label use of morphine. And there is some evidence that topical morphine does reduce the healing rates in wounds, and therefore it's probably only indicated for palliative patients rather than in you know, younger or mobile patients.
I've got a patient in exactly this situation at the moment, so that's really going to be very useful. I'll check with the hospice whether they're aware of that.
Yep. And the other thing to just to keep in mind is that there is some systemic absorption, so you don't narcose your patient with their ulcer treatment. Nice. And also, the deeper the ulcer, the fewer the relevant receptors, pain receptors that are there, so it's less effective in deep ulcers than it is in superficial ulcers. Now we move to breasts. So I've brought this up. I mean, it's a bit of a philosophical discussion, but a recent issue of GP Research Review summarized a 2023 meta-analysis of MRI imaging as a screening modality in women at high risk of breast cancer. And it showed that MRI alone increased the detection rate of breast cancer versus mammography alone by 8 per 1,000 women screened, while MRI plus mammography had a better detection rate versus MRI alone by 1 per 1,000. So there wasn't a huge benefit adding in mammography to MRI alone in higher risk women. And these women were particularly those with dense, high breast density, in which mammography is not as effective as women with normal breast density. The reviewer noted there is conflicting evidence around the impact of ionizing radiation from repeated mammography related to mammographic breast screening in women at high risk of malignancy, and concludes that taking this into account, MRI alone may be considered as the best choice in such high-risk women.
Wow.
So it does raise several issues. So what, one is around the issues of informed choice and equity, particularly if private screening is the only way MRI imaging can be accessed in this situation, which would be the case in New Zealand as it stands at the moment. Yeah. And also the issue of reporting of breast density and management of women with extremely dense breasts within the current breast screen Aotearoa screening program. So the BSA, Breast Screen Aotearoa, looked at their reporting requirements reasonably recently as part of a quality improvement review, and remain of the process that women are not notified if they have extremely dense breasts, although that stands against some international recommendations such as the European Society of Breast Imaging, which recommended last year that women should be informed of their individual breast density and the diagnostic and prognostic implications of having dense breasts, and that supplemental or standalone MRI should be offered to women with extremely dense breasts from age 50 to 70, preferably every 2 to 3 years. So that's an international recommendation. And yet we're stuck still at the moment in the situation where these high-risk women won't necessarily even be aware that they are at increased risk because of their breast density.
And we can't even advise them if we're not told in the mammogram report.
And the report, So I think if the women have had mammograms privately, there's likely to be a comment on breast density. And again, you know, we could say, well, that we should be aware of that and maybe be offering these women MRI as a screening modality. But we've got to look at the equity issue at the same time, which is, you know, this is a small portion of the population that can afford private mammography in the first instance and that can then afford MRI.
And you wonder if that's why BSA aren't doing the report, because if they mention it then and the service isn't available to actually follow through with that because of resource constraints, then the decision is not to report it because nothing can be done about it.
Yep.
They're making an assumption that people are not going to be able to follow through with purchasing things privately currently. And it also means that there isn't a push for an introduction of a publicly funded MRI breast screening program for women in this situation.
Yeah, it really illustrates the tension, I think, between the components that are required for a screening program, which include, you know, access to whatever the screening throws up, versus the code of rights, which is you have the right to be fully informed.
Yeah.
So I think this will be sorted over the next couple of years, but certainly, again, HTC has had complaints from women who, around this very issue of not being notified, they had very dense breasts and the implications of that.
Well, putting the powers that be that might be listening to the podcast on notice. This is something we are all now aware of.
I'm sure it'll be under review.
It should be under review.
And just two lighter issues to finish off today, again, from GP Research Review, issue 216. And worth subscribing to.
There are lighter things in GP Research.
There are.
Reading it for my bedtime reading for entertainment today.
Well, these may or may not have practical application in your in your day-to-day practice, but the first one was a randomized controlled trial on the effects of light music played by piano on satisfaction, anxiety, and pain in patients undergoing colonoscopy.
Whilst they were having the colonoscopy, they were playing the piano.
They were playing light piano music. I don't think they had Liberace in the corner, but they probably had the CD going, I suppose.
No, so it wasn't the patient themselves playing the piano while the colonoscopy was going.
Okay. No, that would require an interesting sort of piano stool.
Yes.
Anyway, what the study showed was significantly lower anxiety scores and higher overall satisfaction scores, including satisfaction with pain management, following the procedure in the piano group than the group with no music. So the reviewer commented that the results appear to be perfectly tailored to a GP's waiting room. Less anxiety, more satisfaction, and less pain, and at no cost. Probably worth swapping the blaring radio ads, music in the waiting room for something soothing like Mozart.
Nice.
So something to consider. So finally, ending up on the genitals, as I promised, this is a randomized trial on the effects of a topical hop extract gel versus topical estradiol cream for treatment of postmenopausal hop as in beer hop.
Okay.
And this was for the treatment of postmenopausal sexual dysfunction. And the trial showed no difference between the two creams in terms of the total female sexual function index, FSFI, or subscores, which were sexual desire, sexual arousal, vaginal lubrication, satisfaction, orgasm, sexual pain. So the two groups were equal. No adverse events.
Right.
And I thought, well, where did this come from? But Humulus lupulus, which is the hop, has been recognized as having antioxidant, anti-inflammatory, anti-cancer, and estrogenic properties.
Right.
It's a shame the alcohol and beer then negates most of those properties, I think. But, so I took my life in my hands and tried to find if there were any vaginal hop creams commercially available. And I don't recommend Googling vaginal hop cream. But
have safe search on?
I didn't. But anyway, something hopeful sounding did come up, which was Tired Hands Hop Cream. So I went into the site and it turned out to be a beer. So
right.
I have left the link to Tired Hands Hop Cream if you want to try a nice beer from Arkansas or somewhere. But
thank you very
much. I was unsuccessful otherwise.
So is this like a byproduct of the craft beer industry, the ability to make the hop cream, or is it a standalone thing itself?
Yeah, no, I think it's another use for the hop. So it's not a use for the hops discarded by the beer industry.
So if the beer industry doesn't want to use the hop, then it can be made into this cream.
Yeah, we could say it could be an industry competing for the hop market eventually.
Yeah, yeah. The person that first thought of that deserves to be, I don't know, explored, I think.
it's probably along the lines of the wild yam creams, which, you know, if the vegetable or herb is known to have some sort of estrogenic properties, then, you know, it might be useful topically as well as systemically.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Well, thank you, Dave. It's been absolutely awesome once again. So you've talked about superficial venous thrombosis and the very significant changes in recommendations around that, particularly because of the link with deep vein thrombosis, ACE inhibitors and angioedema. And one of the key things for me is that can be something that arises months or weeks or years after you've started your ACE inhibitor. And it may show itself as abdominal pain and diarrhea, as well as what we might sort of typically think of around the swelling around the face and the lips. You reminded us about the special authority change to ivermectin, so that if we're treating scabies with ivermectin, which is a really effective treatment for those people who've got particularly quite extensive scabies, but with the rise in resistance of scabies, you know, this may be more commonly prescribed, but we don't have to talk to a specialist microbiologist about that anymore. Allopurinol, and I think one of the key things there, I mean, not only is we know that the inequities both in gout and in gout management are there, but the complexity of the education we need to do around patients to make sure that they stay on their allopurinol, because you know, even within a month of stopping it, you can't restart on the same dose. You have to restart the lower dose because of this increased risk of allopurinol hypersensitivity syndrome, which is really significant side effect. Or there was a bit about leg ulcers and topical anesthetic, which again, I'd like you got in my head that it was a no-no to apply, but there's a couple of options there. Numet cream, the M cream, and potentially morphine mixed in with other gels, although that's off-label, obviously. I think that's the issue around dense breasts and MRI scanning is a real knotty one. And I think it's really just to alert our colleagues to that. If you do see that in a mammogram report, it's likely to be a private mammogram report, but the implications of that is perhaps that person should be having MRI mammograms, but there's maybe some work for us to do around improving the system around that. And then playing light music, piano music, reduces anxiety and pain during a colonoscopy. And there's a rival for estrogen cream, if you can get it, hop cream for postmenopausal sexual dysfunction. So I think it's one of those watch this spaces. And seriously, another indication of how these complementary medicines may have really valuable things to contribute. And those of us who come from a Western paradigm, you know, we need to keep our minds open to the value of complementary and alternative medicines. Where they do where they add value, you know, we should learn about them, not something to dismiss.
Well said.
Thanks, Dave. That's awesome. We'll see you again next month.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Please like and share this podcast if you found it useful. The show notes on the podcast website contain links to all the resources that we discussed. A video version of this podcast is available on the Pinnacle Practice website at pinnacle.co.nz. Ka kite anō.